Part 2. Pursuit Remembered. Chapter 3. It dated back to the time of Droopy, after I'd come back from being ill in Nairobi and we had gone on a foot safari to hunt rhino in the forest. Droopy was a real savage with lids to his eyes that nearly covered them, handsome, with a great deal of style, a fine hunter, and a beautiful tracker. He was about 35, I should think, and wore only a piece of cloth, knotted over one shoulder, and a fez that some hunter had given him. He always carried a spear. Imkolo wore an old U.S. Army khaki tunic, complete with buttons, that had originally been brought out for Droopy, who had been away somewhere and had missed getting it. Twice Pop had brought it out for Droopy, and finally Imkolo had said, "Give it to me." Pop had let him have it, and Imkolo had worn it ever since. It, a pair of shorts, his fuzzy wool curler's cap, and a knitted army sweater he wore when he was washing the tunic, were the only garments I ever saw in the old man until he took my bird shooting coat. For shoes, he used sandals cut from old motor car tires. He had slim, handsome legs with well-turned ankles on the style of Babe Ruth's, and I remember how surprised I was the first time I saw him with the tunic off and noticed how old his upper body was. It had that age look you see in photographs of Jeffries and Sharkey posing 30 years after, the ugly old man biceps and the fallen pectoral muscles. "How old is Imkolo?" I asked Pop.
"Must be over 50," Pop said. "He's got a grown-up family in the native reserve."
"How are his kids?"
"No good, worthless. He can't handle them. We tried one as a porter, but he was no good."
Imkolo was not jealous of Droopy. He simply knew that Droop was a better man than he was, more of a hunter, a faster and cleaner tracker, and a great stylist in everything he did. He admired Droopy in the same way we did, and being out with them, it made him realize that he was wearing Droopy's tunic, and that he had been a porter before he became a gun-bearer, and suddenly he ceased being an old-timer, and we were hunting together. He and I hunting together, and Droopy in command of the show. That had been a fine hunt. The afternoon of the day we came into the country, we walked about 4 miles from camp along the deep rhino trail that graded through the grassy hills with their abandoned orchard-looking trees, as smoothly and evenly as though an engineer had planned it. The trail was a foot deep in the ground and smoothly worn, and we left it where it slanted down through a divide in the hills like a dry irrigation ditch and climbed, sweating, the small, steep hill on the right, to sit there with our backs against the hilltop and glass the country. It was a green, pleasant country, with hills below the forest that grew thick on the side of a mountain, and it was cut by the valleys of several watercourses that came down out of the thick timber on the mountain. Fingers of the forest came down onto the heads of some of the slopes, and it was there, at the forest edge, that we watched for rhino to come out. If you looked away from the forest and the mountainside, you could follow the watercourses and the hilly slope of the land down until the land flattened, and the grass was brown and burned, and away across a long sweep of country was the brown rift valley and the shine of Lake Manyara. We lay there on the hillside and watched the country carefully for rhino. Droopy was on the other side of the hilltop, squatted on his heels, looking, and Imkolo sat below us. There was a cool breeze from the east, and it blew the grass in waves on the hillsides. There were many large white clouds, and the tall trees of the forest on the mountainside grew so closely and were so foliaged that it looked as though you could walk on their tops. Behind this mountain there was a gap, and then another mountain, and the far mountain was dark blue with forest in the distance. Until 5 o'clock we did not see anything. Then, without the glasses, I saw something moving over the shoulder of one of the valleys towards a strip of the timber. In the glasses it was a rhino, showing very clear, and a minute at the distance red-colored in the sun, moving with a quick water-bug-like motion across the hill. Then there were 3 more of them that came out of the forest, dark in the shadow, and 2 that fought tinily in the glasses, pushing head-on, fighting in front of a clump of bushes while we watched them, and the light failed. It was too dark to get down the hill, across the valley, and up the narrow slope of mountainside to them in time for a shot. So we went back to the camp, down the hill in the dark, edging down on our shoes, and then feeling the trail smooth underfoot, walking along that deep trail that wound through the dark hills until we saw the firelight in the trees. We were excited that night because we had seen the 3 rhino, and early the next morning, while we were eating breakfast before starting out, Droopy came in to report a herd of buffalo he had found feeding at the edge of the forest, not 2 miles from camp. We went there, still tasting coffee and kippers in the early morning, heart pounding of excitement.
and the native Droopy had left watching them pointed where they had crossed a deep gulch and gone into an open patch of forest. He said there were two big bulls in a herd of a dozen or more. We followed them in, moving very quietly on the game trails, pushing the vines aside and seeing the tracks and the quantities of fresh dung. But though we went on into the forest where it was too thick to shoot and made a wide circle, we did not see or hear them. Once we heard the tick birds and saw them flying, but that was all. There were numbers of rhino trails there in the woods and many strawy piles of dung, but we saw nothing but the green wood pigeons and some monkeys. And when we came out, we were wet to our waist from the dew and the sun was quite high. The day was very hot, now before the wind had gotten up, and we knew whatever rhino and buffalo had been out would have gone back deep into the forest to rest out of the heat. The others started back to camp with Pop and Imkola. There was no meat in camp, and I wanted to hunt back in a circle with Droopy to see if we could kill a piece. I was beginning to feel strong again after the dysentery, and it was a pleasure to walk in the easy rolling country, simply to walk, and to be able to hunt, not knowing what we might see, and free to shoot for the meat we needed. Then, too, I liked Droopy, and I liked to watch him walk. He strode very loosely and with a slight lift, and I liked to watch him and to feel the grass under my soft-soled shoes and the pleasant weight of the rifle held just back of the muzzle, the barrel resting on my shoulder, and the sun hot enough to sweat you well as it burned the dew from the grass. With the breeze starting and the country like an abandoned New England orchard to walk through, I knew that I was shooting well again, and I wanted to make a shot to impress Droopy. From the top of one rise, we saw two Kungonis showing yellow on a hillside about a mile away, and I motioned to Droop that we would go after them. We started down, and in a ravine jumped a waterbuck bull and two cows. Waterbuck was the one animal we might get that I knew was worthless as meat, and I had shot a better head than this one carried. I had the sights on the buck as he tore away, remembered about the worthless meat and having the head, and did not shoot.
"No shoot, Kuru?" Droopy asked in Swahili. "Duomo sana? A good bull?"
I tried to tell him that I had a better one and that it was no good to eat. He grinned.
"Piga Kongoni Mazuri."
Piga was a fine word. It sounded exactly as the command to fire should sound or the announcement of a hit. Mazuri, meaning good, well, better, had sounded too much like the name of a state for a long time, and walking I used to make up sentences in Swahili with Arkansas and Missouri in them, but now it seemed natural, no longer to be italicized, just as all the words came to seem the proper and natural words, and there was nothing odd or unseemly in the stretching of the ears, in the tribal scars, or in a man carrying a spear. The tribal marks and the tattooed places seemed natural, and handsome adornments, and I regretted not having any of my own. My own scars were all informal, some irregular and sprawling, others simply puffy welts. I had one on my forehead that people still commented on, asking if I'd bumped my head, but Droop had handsome ones beside his cheekbones and others, symmetrical and decorative, on his chest and belly. I was thinking that I had one good one, a sort of embossed Christmas tree on the bottom of my right foot that only served to wear out socks, when we jumped two reed buck. They went off through the trees and then stood at 60 yards, the thin, graceful buck looking back, and I shot him high and a touch behind the shoulder. He gave a jump and went off very fast.
"Piga!"
Droopy smiled. We had both heard the wonk of the bullet.
"Kufa,"
I told him.
"Dead."
But when we came up to him, lying on his side, his heart was still beating strongly, although to all appearances he was dead. Droopy had no skinning knife, and I had only a pen knife to stick him with. I felt for the heart behind the foreleg with my fingers, and feeling it beating under the hide, slipped the knife in, but it was short and pushed the heart away. I could feel it hot and rubbery against my fingers, and feel the knife push it, but I felt around and cut the big artery and the blood came hot against my fingers. Once bled, I started to open him, with a little knife still showing off to Droopy, and emptying him neatly took out the liver, cut away the gall, and laying the liver on a hummock of grass, put the kidneys beside it. Droopy asked for the knife. Now he was going to show me something. Skillfully, he slid open the stomach and turned it inside, tripe side out, emptying the grass in it on the ground, shook it, then put the liver and kidneys inside it, and with the knife cut a switch from the tree that Buck lay under, and sewed the stomach together with the width so the tripe made a bag to carry the other delicacies in. Then he cut a pole and put the bag on the end of it,
running it through the flaps, and put it over his shoulder in the way tramps carried their property in a handkerchief on the end of a stick in a Blue Jay corn plaster advertisements when we were children. It was a good trick, and I thought how I would show it to John Stabe in Wyoming sometime and how he would smile his deaf man smile. You had to throw pebbles at him to make him stop when you heard a bull bugle, and I knew what John would say. He would say, "By God, Ernst, that's smart." Droop handed me the stick, then took off his single garment, made a sling, and got the buck up on his back. I tried to help him and suggest by signs that we cut a pole and sling him, carry him between us, but he wanted to carry him alone. So we started for camp, me with the tripe bag on the end of a stick over my shoulder, my rifle slung, and Droopy staggering steadily ahead, sweating heavily under the buck. I tried to get him to hang him in a tree and leave him until we could send out a couple of porters, and to that end we put him in the crotch of a tree. But when Droop saw that I meant to go off and leave him there rather than simply allow him to drain, he got him down on his shoulders again, and we went on into camp, the boys around the cooking fire all laughing at the tripe bag over my shoulder as we came in. This was the kind of hunting that I liked. No riding in cars, the country broken up instead of the plains, and I was completely happy. I had been quite ill and had that pleasant feeling of getting stronger each day. I was underweight and had a great appetite for meat and could eat all I wanted without feeling stuffy. Each day I sweated out whatever we drank sitting at the fire at night, and in the heat of the day now, I lay in the shade with the breeze and the trees and read with no obligation and no compulsion to write, happy in knowing that at 4 o'clock we would be starting out to hunt again. I would not even write a letter. The only person I really cared about except the children was with me, and I had no wish to share this life with anyone who was not there, only to live it, being completely happy and quite tired. I knew that I was shooting well, and I had that feeling of well-being and confidence that is so much more pleasant to have than to hear about. As it turned out, we started soon after 3 to be on the hill by 4. But it was nearly 5 before we saw the first rhino come bustling short-leggedly across the ridge of the hill in almost the same place where we had seen the rhino the night before. We saw where he went into the edge of the forest near where we had seen the 2 fighting, and then took a course that would lead us down the hill, across the grown-over gully at the bottom, and up the steep slope to where there was the thorn tree with yellow blossoms that marked the place where we had seen the rhino go in. Coming straight up the slope inside of the thorn tree, the wind blowing across the hill, I tried to walk as slowly as I could and put a handkerchief inside the sweatband of my hat to keep the perspiration out of my glasses. I expected to shoot at any minute, and I wanted to slow up enough so my heart would not be pounding. In shooting large animals, there's no reason ever to miss if you have a clean shot and can shoot and know where to shoot, unless you are unsteady from a run or a climb or fog your glasses, break them, or run out of cloth or paper to wipe them clean. The glasses were the biggest hazard, and I used to carry 4 handkerchiefs and change them from the left to the right pocket when they were wet. We came up to the yellow blossom tree very carefully, like people walking up to a covey of quail the dogs had pointed, and the rhino was not in sight. We went all through the edge of the forest, and it was full of tracks and fresh rhino sign, but there was no rhino. The sun was setting, and it was getting too dark to shoot, but we followed the forest around the side of the mountain, hoping to see a rhino in the open glades. When it was almost too dark to shoot, I saw Droopy stop and crouch. With his head down, he motioned us forward. Crawling up, we saw a large rhino and a small one standing chest deep in brush, facing us across a little valley.
"Cow and calf," Pop said softly. "Can't shoot her. Let me look at her horn."
He took the glasses from Imkola.
"Can she see us?"
POM asked.
"No."
"How far are they?"
"Must be nearly 500 yards.
"My God, she looks big," I whispered.
"She's a big cow," Pop said. "Wonder what became of the bull."
He was pleased and excited by the sight of game.
"Too dark to shoot unless we're right on him."
The rhinos had turned and were feeding. They never seemed to move slowly. They either bustled or stood still.
"What makes them so red?" POM asked.
"Rolling in the mud," Pop answered. "We better get along while there's light."
The sun was down when we came out of the forest and looked down the slope and across to the hill where we had watched from with our glasses. We should have backtracked and gone down, crossed the gulch, and climbed back up the trail the way we had come, but we decided, like fools, to grade straight across the mountainside below the edge of the forest. So, in the dark, following this ideal line,
We descended into steep ravines that showed only as wooded patches until you were in them, slid down, clung to vines, stumbled and climbed and slid again, down and down, then steeply, impossibly up, hearing the rustle of night things and the cough of a leopard hunting baboons, me scared of snakes and touching each root and branch with snake fear in the dark. To go down and up, two hands and knee, climbing ravines, and then out into the moonlight and the long, too steep shoulder of the mountain that you climbed 1 foot up to the other, 1 foot after the other, one stride at a time, leaning forward against the grade in the altitude, dead tired and gun-weary, single file in the moonlight, across the slope, on, up, and to the top where it was easy. The country spread in the moonlight, then up and down and on through the small hills. Tired, but now inside of the fires and on into camp. So then you sit, bundled against the evening chill, at the fire with a whiskey and soda, waiting for the announcement that the canvas bath had been a quarter filled with hot water.
Bathi buona!
God damn it, I could never hunt sheep again, you say.
I never could, says P.O.M. You all made me.
You climbed a damn sight better than any of us.
Do you suppose we could hunt sheep again, Pop?
I wonder, Pop said. I suppose it's merely condition. It's riding in the damn cars that ruins us.
If we did that walk every night, we could come back in 3 nights from now and never feel it.
Yes, but I'd be as scared of snakes if we did it every night for a year.
You'd get over it.
No, I said. They scare me stiff. Do you remember that time we touched hands behind the tree?
Rather, said Pop. You jump 2 yards. Are you really afraid of them or only talking?
They scare me sick, I said. They always have.
What's the matter with you men, P.O.M. said. Why haven't I heard anything about the war tonight?
We're too bloody tired. Were you in the war, Pop?
Not me, said Pop.
Where is that boy with the whiskey? Then, calling in that feeble, clowning falsetto,
Katie! Katie!
Bathy, said Molo again softly but insistently. Too tired.
Mimsahib Bathi, Molo said hopefully.
I'll go, said P.O.M., but you two hurry up with your drinking. I'm hungry.
Bathi,
said Katie severely to Pop.
Bathi yourself, said Pop. Don't bully me.
Katie turned away in the firelit, slanting smile.
All right, said Pop. Gonna have one?
He asked.
We'll have just one, I said, and then we'll bati.
Bati, buana, mkumba, Mola said. P.O.M. came toward the fire wearing her blue dressing gown and mosquito boots.
Go on, she said. You can have another when you come out. There's nice, warm, muddy water.
They bully us, Pop said.
Do you remember the time we were sheep hunting and your hat blew off and nearly fell into the ram? I asked her, the whiskey racing my mind back to Wyoming.
Go take your bathy, P.O.M. said. I'm going to have a gimlet.
In the morning, we were dressed before daylight, ate breakfast, and were hunting the forest edge in the sunken valleys where Droop had seen the buffalo before the sun was up. But they were not there. It was a long hunt, and we came back to camp and decided to send the trucks for porters and move with a foot safari to where there was supposed to be water in a stream that came down out of the mountain beyond where we had seen the rhinos the night before. Being camped there, we could hunt a new country along the forest edge, and we would be much closer to the mountain. The trucks were to bring in Carl from his kudu camp where he seemed to be getting disgusted or discouraged or both, and we could go down to the Rift Valley the next day and kill some meat and try for an oryx. If we found good rhino, we would send for him. We did not want to fire any shots where we were going except at rhino in order not to scare them, and we needed meat. The rhinos seemed very shy, and I knew from Wyoming how the shy game will all shift out of a country being an area, a valley, or a range of hills a man can hunt in after a shot or two. We planned this all out, Pop consulting with Droopy, and then sent the trucks off with Dan to recruit porters. Late in the afternoon, they were back with Carl, his outfit, and 40 Imbulas, good-looking savages with a pompous headman who wore the only pair of shorts among them. Carl was thin now, his skin sallow, his eyes very tired-looking, and he seemed a little desperate. He had been 8 days in the kudu camp in the hills, hunting hard, with no one with him who spoke any English, and they'd only seen 2 cows and jumped a bull out of range. The guides claimed they had seen another bull, but Carl thought it was a Congoni, or that they'd said it was a Kongoni and had not shot. He was bitter about this, and it was not a happy outfit.
I never saw the horns. I don't believe it was a bull, he said.
Kudu hunting was a touchy subject with him now, and we let it alone.
He'll get an oryx down there, and he'll feel better, Pop said. It's gotten on his nerves a little.
Carl agreed to the plan for us to move ahead into the new country, and for him to go down for meat.
Whatever you say, he said. Absolutely whatever you say.
It will give him some shooting, Pop said. Then he'll feel better. We'll get one, and then you get one. Whoever gets his first can go down after an oryx. We'll probably get an oryx tomorrow anyway when you're hunting meat.
Whatever you say, Carl said.
His mind was bitterly revolving 8 blank days of hill climbing in the heat, out before daylight, back at dark, hunting an animal whose Swahili name he could not then remember, with trackers in whom he had no confidence, coming back to eat alone, no one to whom he could talk, his wife 9,000 miles and 3 months away. And how was his dog, and how was his job, and God damn it, where were they, and what if he missed one when he got a shot? He wouldn't. You never miss when it was really important. He was sure of that. That was one of the tenets of his faith. But what if he got excited and missed? And why didn't he get any letters? What did the guide say Kongoni for that time? They did. He knew they did. But he said nothing of all that, only, whatever you say, a little desperately. Come on, cheer up, you bastard, I said.
I'm cheerful. What's the matter with you?
Have a drink.
I don't want a drink. I want a goddamn kudu.
Later, Pop said, I thought he'd do well off by himself with no one to hurry him or rattle him. He'll be all right. He's a good lad. He wants someone to tell him exactly what to do and still leave him alone and not rattle him, I said. It's hell for him to shoot in front of everybody. He's not a damn show-off like me.
He made a damn fine shot at that leopard, Pop said.
Two of them, I said. The second was as good as the first. Hell, he can shoot. On the range, he'll shoot the pants off any of us. But he worries about it, and I rattle him trying to get him to speed up.
You're a little hard on him sometimes, Pop said.
Hell, he knows me. He knows what I think of him. He doesn't mind. I still think he'll find himself off by himself, Pop said. It's just a question of confidence. He's really a good shot.
Hell, he's got the best buff, the best water buck, and the best lion now, I said. He's got nothing to worry about.
The Mem-Sahib has the best lion, brother. Don't make any mistake about that. I'm glad of that. But he's got a damn fine lion and a big leopard. Everything he has is good. We've got plenty of time. He's got nothing to worry about. What the hell's he so gloomy about?
We'll get an early start in the morning so we can finish it off before it gets too hot for the little Mem-Sahib.
She's in the best shape of anyone.
She's marvelous. She's like a little terrier.
We went out that afternoon and glassed the country from the hills and never saw a thing. That night, after supper, we were in the tent. POM disliked intensely being compared to a little terrier. If she must be like any dog, and she did not wish to be, she would prefer a wolfhound, something lean, racy, long-legged, and ornamental. Her courage was so automatic and so much a simple state of being that she never thought of danger. Then, too, danger was in the hands of Pop, and for Pop, she had a complete, clear-seeing, absolute trusting adoration. Pop was her ideal of how a man should be, brave, gentle, comic, never losing his temper, never bragging, never complaining except in a joke, tolerant, understanding, intelligent, drinking a little too much as a good man should, and, to her eyes, very handsome.
Don't you think Pop's handsome?
No, I said. Droopy's handsome.
Droopy's beautiful. But don't you really think Pop's handsome?
Hell no. I like him as well as any man I've ever known. But I'm damned if he's handsome.
I think he's lovely looking. But you understand how I feel about him, don't you?
Sure. I'm as fond of the bastard myself.
But don't you think he's handsome, really?
Nope. Then a little later. Well, who's handsome to you?
Belmont and Pop and you.
Don't be patriotic, I said. Who's a beautiful woman?
Garbo.
Not anymore. Josie is. Margot is.
Yes, they are. I know I'm not.
You're lovely.
Let's talk about Mr. J.P. I don't like you to call him Pop. It's not dignified.
He and I aren't dignified together.
Yes, but I'm dignified with him. Don't you think he's wonderful?
Yes, and he doesn't have to read books written by some female he's tried to help get published saying how he's yellow.
She's just jealous and malicious. You never should have helped her. Some people never forgive that.
It's a damn shame, though, with all that talent gone to malice and nonsense and self-praise. It's a goddamn shame, really. It's a shame you never knew her before she went to pot. You know a funny thing? She never could write dialogue. It was terrible. She learned how to do it from my stuff and used it in that book. She had never written like that before. She never could forgive learning that, and she was afraid people would notice it, where she learned it, and so she had to attack me. It's a funny racket, really. But I swear she was damn nice before she got ambitious. You would have liked her then, really.
Maybe, but I don't think so, said P.O.M. We have fun, though, don't we, without all those people?
God damn it if we don't. I had a better time every year since I can remember.
But isn't Mr. J.P. wonderful, really?
Yes, he's wonderful.
Oh, you're nice to say it. Poor Carl.
Why?
Without his wife.
Yes, I said, poor Carl.